And these are the very virtues that hurt them in the way in which you just described. Humility, yeah, for example, is something we would probably generally celebrate, right?
Right.
And yet they are, there's not a way for them to convert that humility into, but the farmer whose land stole, you know, who stole their land from indigenous peoples generations ago is able to tell a story about the legacy of coffee in their family,
right,
and the South.
This episode is proudly brought to you by Mapper Forward's workshop, It's Time to Become a Coffee Consultant. Learn how to diversify your revenue streams and create freedom from your day job while saying goodbye to that alarm clock forever by becoming a consultant within the coffee industry or directly to consumers who have shifted towards home brewing and home roasting. Protect your income from challenging times in the coffee value chain by taking this course today. Go to mapperforward.coffee/workshops or click the link in the show notes for details. Welcome to the Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward, friends. I'm your host, Leah Safar, and this is episode 3 of a 5-part series, a very delicious conversation with Ted Fisher, author and anthropologist. We are talking about how the value is created in the specialty coffee market. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about comparing like with like. And what we mean by that is when we talk about the coffee producer qualifying the experience between what kind of coffee producer that is, there's 12.5 million coffee producers in the world, and not all coffee producers are created equal. Much the same as there are many, many, many coffee roasters in the world, and not all coffee roasters are created equal, nor can they all be put into the same category. So, Ted, talk to us about why this is important and why it's important to differentiate all of these things when we are creating context.
Well, especially in, and I think it's least apparent on the producer end. I mean, we kind of know, yeah, a Starbucks or a Caribou or a Lucky versus a local coffee shop. But I think it's really easy for consumers and roasters even to get confused about the size and the power, to connect it to our previous conversation, of different roasters. And so Guatemala is the producing country I know best. And for example, what gets celebrated as single estate relationship coffee, support this farmer, they're generally not actually what I would consider to be small holding farmers. They're medium sized farms. They're smaller big farms or bigger medium sized farms. And the thing is, it's because they're the ones who are able to tap into this market. They're the ones who have the financial resources to produce more interesting coffees and sort of play around with flavor profiles. But even more important than that, they have what I would call the social and cultural capital to talk to the consumer market. A real small holding producer of the sort that I work with in Guatemala may not speak Spanish. They would speak a Mayan language as their native language, or they may speak generally live in very out of the way kind of places. But when a roaster says, okay, I want to form a relationship with a coffee producer, that person would talk to their importer in the States, who would talk with their exporter in Guatemala, who would set up a meeting with somebody who probably speaks English, probably somebody whose farm is off the main highway, so it's not too hard to get to, somebody who could communicate the cultural values around this, right? This farm has been in our family for generations, and it's carved out of the forest, and, you know, the whole story they're able to tell. But you get that into the coffee shop, and you see the picture of the farmer on the back, and you think, and the consumer thinks, oh, wow, I'm supporting a small holding farmer, not realizing, in the context of Guatemala, for example, a fifth generation farmer, that essentially means their family has a lot of blood on their hands about the way they got the land and produced coffee.
Wow. I mean, it's so interesting when we start looking at these kinds of things, because people who haven't visited Origin, who do listen to the podcast or do work in the coffee supply chain, might not know that there are, like, some farms in Brazil, people use a helicopter to get from one end of the farm to the other. That's
absolutely. And some of these specialty copies that we think, just because they're super high-end specialty copies, geez, if I'm spending $40 on 12 ounces or whatever, this must be coming from some super artisanal operation. Well, no, it's a plot carved out of a big thing that they get to by helicopter.
Yeah, that's not where they're making their money, folks, from the 20 pounds of that coffee that they were able to sell. That's not where that's coming from. It's from the hundreds of hectares that they're selling to Nestle or JDE or any of these places, Ecom, whatever. The cute coffee that they're selling you, or the competition coffee, that's not going to make payroll for them or pay for their helicopter.
No. And you get all these small holding farmers, sometimes right in the same area, producing equally good coffees that get left out of that just because they don't have the resources to tap into the market. We did a study a few years back. We identified not Cup of Excellence winners, but Cup of X entrants.
Okay.
In Guatemalan competition. And we mapped some of those farms. And then we identified small holders. Same altitude, same microclimate, same ecosystem. The smallholders often work on the big fincas part-time to just sort of make some real cash so they know the production techniques. Not green coffee from all of those, the COE entrants and the smallholders, had it blind cup. They were cupping about the same. But we also interviewed them about what the Cup of Excellence farms were selling green. At this point, they were selling green farm gate for about $4 a pound. Uh-huh. And the smallholders were selling for a little over $1 a pound. So if it's all about what's in the cup, if it's truly just about objective quality, these small holding farmers should be making $4 a pound too. But they're not. And it's because they've not tapped into the social networks. They don't have the cultural capital. They don't have the financial capital to do that.
And confidence. This is often goes back, you know, women, there's a lot of talk about teaching women how to negotiate. Why? It's not because we're not as smart as men and we're not as driven as men or anything like that. It's that because we've been culturally conditioned not to ask for what we think our value is. And it's the same thing that you're talking about here. People who are poor farmers are culturally conditioned to not ask. They're culturally conditioned to be humble and, you know, be silent and be shy in case they get punished. So they're never going to ask for the $4 when they're used to getting $1. It's a weird, oppressive system that's baked into a kind of a hierarchy that makes sure the big guy continues to stay the big guy without needing to intentionally oppress other people. They do it for them.
No, I think that is so right. And these are the very virtues that hurt them in the way in which you just described. Humility, yeah. For example, is something we would probably generally celebrate, right?
Right.
And yet there's not a way for them to convert that humility into, but the farmer whose land stole their land from indigenous peoples generations ago is able to tell a story about the legacy of coffee in their family.
Right.
And it sounds good.
Tell me, what do you think is going to be, given there are so many pressures, like we were talking in the last episode about where the power dynamic is. Now, as we look into the future of like versus like not being the same thing, and we add to that discussion the idea of power, who's going to survive when it comes to all the pressures that are in this system? Are the economic, financial, geopolitical, logistical and labor pressures that are being put on big business going to make them less agile than the smallholder producers?
Oh, I thought you were going in a completely different direction with that. Wow. Yeah. Well, where I thought you were going with that is that the big producers, as you described for some of these big Brazilian plantations, they're able to hedge their bets, right? So they got different various qualities of coffee, different kinds of varietals. Wherever the market goes, they've got a foot in that they're able to benefit and probably doing other things on the side. So in that sense, players are going to be, are much better positioned than the small players. I had not thought about this other constraint though, but once you start coming in, and I was talking to somebody, now I do have to think about what I can reveal. I was talking to a roaster for a company that was bought not too long ago by a private equity firm.
Uh-huh.
And he was, and it was all about margins, right? We got to hit 8% or whatever it is. And so, yeah, you've had that relationship for 10 years, but
that's too bad.
The price has gotten into, exactly. Those are the kind of constraints that you're talking about.
Correct. So that lack of agility means that because they don't have the relationships that they're focused on anymore, now they're in these profitability constraints. Now they're in these, just-in-time delivery, supply chain constraints. That lack of agility could be something that breaks them. We saw that happen during the pandemic, right? We saw people who were using these supply chain constraints like just-in-time. And folks, if you don't know what that is, what that means is that the stuff that's getting delivered and getting shipped to, let's say, Target, it doesn't sit on a shelf long enough for it to suck up capital. So it arrives in time for it to be put on the shelf in the store so that it's purchased by the consumer as quickly as possible. They do that to try and save on the capital requirements that they need in order to have stock. They all got fucked during the pandemic. And then the ramifications of that were that they placed these huge, massive orders because there was all these supply chain constraints. And then they got fucked even further. Why? Because they were overstocked by the time the stock turned up. It was phenomenal to observe, right?
Totally.
But
in one extreme to the other, that's a great example.
Right.
And I would just add to what you said, it's a way of reducing their costs. It's also a way, speaking of power, of pushing risk away from the core concern, right? So less product I have in stock, if the market shifts and nobody wants that anymore, not on me, it's on my supplier. And that risk, it keeps putting push back down. And that seemed like a brilliant strategy since for the 80s until the pandemic, right?
Yeah. And
we realized.
As long as it's business as usual, these things work well. It's the moment there's a speed hump, but it's a speed hump that you never saw coming. You may be able to get over one speed hump, but when you've got a succession of speed humps, which is what I think is coming, the succession of speed humps is going to create a unique pressure cooker that I don't know who's going to survive. Maybe it's the small guys that will be able to survive because they're not leveraged. They don't have an astronomical, a lot of them, their debt to earnings ratio is just out of control. But for those who did live within their means, they may have the agility to survive something like this compared to businesses who are over leveraged or do have too much overhead or are constrained by logistics. What do you think?
I like that. Yeah, I think that is right. And I'm an optimistic part. I thought I was going to be the optimist here and you were going to be the pessimist, but now you're offering an optimistic take. I like that, and are able to shift with the market more agilely as well and sort of introduce new things. And of course, it's the smallholders that are doing the most right now, being the most innovative in trying to reconfigure supply chain.
I think the thing that I am constantly encouraged by is, for example, the conversation that we had with Angela about the biochar. She's someone who, out of necessity, her farm, she had been told by the FNC, don't bother, scrap the whole project, your trees are 20 years old, the temperature has shifted more than 3 degrees, and all the climatologists say that everything you do isn't going to work. And she took a chance. After 10 years of working in the palm oil industry, she decided to see if the solutions, the solutions they had for palm oil would work. And it did. This is what gives me realistic, I'm a realism, but it gives me realistic hope for this about, you know, it's exciting.
Absolutely. And again, this sort of being connected globally, coffee professionals being collected globally around the world, coming to places like your podcast to hear this stuff, that gives power to smaller players. You can jump through, you don't have to get on in the New York Times or Le Monde. You don't have to go through these gatekeepers, right? And I think technology can be promising that way for, again, my heart with smallholders in this. And so it seems like there should be some way. And people are playing around with this, but we're caught in the coffee world. We're caught in a 19th century supply chain. So in most of Central America, in Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, most of Central America, where coffee is grown is also super, it's a cash economy. You pay farmers cash. It's a narco area. So carrying around wads of cash is difficult. Getting to these farms is not easy at all. So there are a lot of like last mile logistical challenges there. Yeah. But it seems like there could be a platform of connecting roasters to producers that hasn't been realized yet, despite some of the big importers like trying to put photos up and things like that.
Well, and I think the secret sauce is that there's no shortcut. You got to build relationships. Like at the end of the day, you don't have to you don't have to fix the whole world. Work on strengthening your own ecosystem. That's the secret sauce. There's no shortcut. Go meet people, have conversations with them, figure out what works for you and what works for them. Fuck traditional business. If you need to figure out a way to do business that works for both of you and it's not the way that anybody else has done it before, forget everybody else. Figure out what works for you. And then figure out how to scale that.
Totally agree. That's million-dollar advice for everybody listening at home. That is exactly. So, Lee, remind me of what your key missions are for.
Responsible. So our vision, long-term vision for the industry, is for us to help establish an industry that is responsible businesses with responsible pricing models. That's our mandate, is everything that we do is to contribute to an industry that is focused on responsible businesses with responsible pricing models.
And if I remember correctly, your route to doing that is authenticity.
Yeah, our four
transparency,
values.
Transparency, curiosity.
Integrity, authenticity, openness, and curiosity.
And that's sort of what you've just described in relationships as well. Curiosity is the basis of this. An open, honest relationship is transparent, and being authentic, having it be, I think what you were suggesting is not simply a transactional relationship. In business, I mean, there's going to be transactional aspects to it. You can, you know, I'm not living in some kumbaya world where we're all just holding hands and giving everybody, but don't have that be, you know, the sole driving force behind it. Building up an authentic relationship based on honesty and transparency and curiosity. That's what you're describing. And I do think that's both more rewarding for every player. If you're a roaster, if you're a cafe owner, if you're a producer, that's more rewarding. And I would like to think that this is not me just being a Pollyanna. I would like to think that that does provide resiliency for the kinds of challenges you're talking about.
I think there's a lot of people that are counting on that. You know, that's the only way a lot of us are going to weather the storm that's coming. It leads to a life better lived.
Totally. And which ties back into coffee. What do we associate with coffee? We associate it with conviviality, a life well lived, waking up in the morning with a ritual, whatever it may be. Coffee is about a life well lived in so many ways.
Which is a perfect setup for our next conversation, which is about the role that golden espresso machines play in our industry. And I'm going to have a little more to say than what I've had to say on social media about this. So join us for the next episode, folks. Peace, love, and peanut butter. Have an amazing rest of your day.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode, friends. Please don't forget to show us some love by subscribing, liking, commenting, and most of all, sharing this podcast with your friends. Check the show notes for links, including our sponsors and our Patreon, and stay tuned for more great conversations on the Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward.